Our first speaker will be Patrick Bond. Although Patrick was born in Ireland and studied in the United States, he has lived and worked in South Africa for the past 11 years. He is the author of numerous books, including the forthcoming Anti-Globalization Apartheid, South Africa Meets the World Bank, IMF, and International Finance. In addition to his academic work, Patrick is active in several urban, social, labor, and environmental movements, including the Rio Plus 10 conference, which will be held this September at Wits University, South Africa. This conference will serve as another prominent site of anti-capitalist organization in the Third World. Please join me in welcoming Patrick Bond.
Thanks. I'm very, very honored to be here. I've spent the last 2 weeks at York with fantastic folks, 36 students and colleagues who've really helped me understand a lot more about your circumstances here. It's a great privilege for me. I like to ground myself as much as I can. Maybe we can dim one of the lights to make it a bit more cozy for a couple of... Just to sort of set the scene and give you a sense of, a flavor of the character of the anti-capitalist movement in South Africa, the sort of groups that have mobilized, this case coming to Washington last April, where, though I don't claim any mandate, I certainly try to ground myself and will report, in a sense, on the sentiments and the ideas and the solidarity expected. I think at one level, this is a movement where we've got, for example, a Soweto activist leader, Trevor Ngwane, absolutely fearless in confronting power locally, nationally, globally in South Africa. In this case, blaming George Soros sitting in Davos, Switzerland in January, while Trevor Ngwane in Porto Alegre for the World Social Forum, explaining that it was Soros and the pressure that he put on the first democratic government of South Africa to ensure fiscal discipline that was responsible for the outbreak of 100,000 cases of cholera over the last 10 months. 100,000 cases of cholera as World Bank policies designed to ensure full cost recovery, even on rural water supply systems that were installed since 1994, meant that what had been even free under apartheid, some old homeland schemes, were cut off last August. So this extraordinary reflection, in a sense, in a very material way, the gender implications very, very extreme, since it's women, rural women, in the residue of apartheid, still responsible, as the men are still ensconced in a migrant labor system for bearing the reproduction costs in the society from this process. Incidentally, Soros, interviewed afterwards, agreed, yes, actually, that South African has a point. South Africa is in the hands of global capital. Others that have given us some enormous inspiration, the official biographer of Nelson Mandela, Fatima Meer, bringing the local and global together in Durban, and that'll be on your screens, your radar screens, in the next few weeks as the World Conference Against Racism occurs there, amidst a backdrop of a call for reparations, particularly reparations in which Archbishop Njengankulu Ndengani, the successor to Archbishop Tutu, has led the call when he was, in this case, in Davos, Switzerland, with Yasmin Suka, who was a great leader of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, calling for reparations from the Swiss banks that kept apartheid alive in the 1980s, kept rolling over loans. As Archbishop Ndengani says to the Swiss banks, it took you folks 50 years to compensate victims of the Holocaust. Don't take that long for blacks in South Africa. And indeed, that call for reparations being made more and more explicitly around ecological debt, the third world debt, the odious debt to dictators, the unpayable debt, sometimes taking the form very explicitly, at going, as we'll see in a moment, to the nerve center of international finance, Washington last April, where the leading Zimbabwean debt activist, Davy Malengisa, and a key student activist, Molly Dlamini, were calling with the entire Southern African delegation, not for the reform of the World Bank, but its abolition. The key intellectual and international activist who spent some time in the 60s on Robben Island with Nelson Mandela, Dennis Brutus, was one of the launchers and the mobilizers behind the World Bank bonds boycott. Here he is in Prague helping to shut down the last day of the World Bank IMF annual meeting. a prelude to what will happen in Washington in early October this year. Neville Gabriel, our Jubilee 2000 General Secretary last year, speaking incidentally in this case to Mampela Rampele, who is known for having moved from a radical black consciousness standpoint, where she worked very closely with Steve Biko, to now becoming number three managing director in the World Bank responsible for social development. Really speaking truth to power, Neville, telling them that they're going to have to close up shop, as did Trevor Ngwane in this film Two Trevors Go to Washington, the chair of the IMF World Bank last year, the South African finance minister, Trevor Manuel. You see him in this shot in April last year trying to persuade the bank and the fund to operate more democratically without that huge U.S. veto, which, of course, Canada invariably goes along with, not necessarily that it's been applied, but that consensus, that Washington consensus, operates, of course, right up to the Liberals in Ottawa. Trevor Manuel's gotten nowhere. These chaps, Stan Fisher, who was raised in South Africa, James Wolfenson, absolutely turning down and instead resorting to the monopoly of violence here, in this case, very nicely portrayed against the folks that they're meant to protect here. So the expanding arm of the state and the apparatus, which will be again called upon in early October in Washington, as we see the anti-World Bank forces mobilize around bank headquarters. They've just this week announced they won't be holding the annual World Bank IMF meetings in the normal place, the big hotel on Rock Creek Parkway, I think for fear that the Zapatistas will be teaching us how to do our sort of movements from the foliage of the parkway, and they're now going to go into their lager in the World Bank meetings. Still, with the example that I'll mention in a moment of solidarity that the ACT UP and Médecins Sans Frontières, Oxfam and others have given the treatment action campaign, the solidarity around mass campaigning and the call from the mass movements of the South, not simply in the big northern centers where we see these meetings, Quebec City, Prague, Washington, Seattle, Nice, or next week, Genoa, but also in a series of protests across the third world. I have a list, and it's such a long list of really dozens of events that happened in the year after Seattle, but just a few. I mean, Ecuador last January 2000, breaking out with a momentary alliance with the indigenous folks and the military. Bangkok in February, a formidable group of Thai activists. In March, Cochabamba, Bolivia, that pushed out water privatization. Solidarity activism across the world, including third world centers in April around the IMF World Bank meeting. In early May, Chiang Mai, Thailand, a small city but host to the Asian Development Bank meeting, shut down by 5,000 angry students, unemployed workers, and especially the rural poor. South Africa, we had in this case in May a day-long stay away that was basically everyone taking a day off in protest. 4.5 million workers lost that day's pay to make their point against globalization and neoliberalism. The next day in India, 20 million did the same. And then subsequently in coming weeks and months, about a year ago, you saw Argentina, Turkey, Port-au-Prince and Haiti, in Paraguay, in Nigeria, mass strikes that resulted in many cases in very, very severe confrontations and tens and tens of thousands of people in each case being involved in protest. The Chad-Cameroon pipeline motivating a lot of third world protest in Africa in solidarity. The Korean workers in July last year repeatedly demonstrating against IMF-mandated austerity policies. The Brazilian left with a plebiscite last August. 6 million people voted virtually unanimously against the proposed IMF program there. Solidarity around the S26 protests in Prague, Bolivia exploding subsequently with protest in October, tens of thousands of Korean workers again taking up the struggle in Argentina, in Turkey, in recent weeks in Colombia. Again and again we find the mirror image in the South of these protests. What is going on? Can we call this protest against globalization? Is there a universal way to name the system? I think we'll want to talk explicitly about the capitalist character of international oppression, the new face of imperialism. But one phrase that's come up, and I'll just read this for you for one paragraph here, to characterize some of this, really explicitly incorporating the racial and the gender character of the oppression, is global apartheid. Sally Booker and William Minter in The Nation last week described it as such. It's an international system of minority rule whose attributes include differential access to basic human rights, wealth and power structured by race and place, structural racism embedded in global economic processes, political institutions, and cultural assumptions, and the international practice of double standards that assume inferior rights to be appropriate for certain others, defined by location, origin, race, or gender. And again, the gender dimension, certainly with apartheid being absolutely dependent upon rural black women for the basis of reproduction of labor in a situation which ensured super profits for white-owned companies in South Africa. That mode of super exploitation, very much in evidence today as third world women's living standards are most explicitly cut, again, as the race to the bottom for wages and working conditions continues. So here we have global apartheid. I think, as I was showing you, there is a name and an address, and we find it often in Washington, in Geneva, in the New York Financial District, Frankfurt, Tokyo, London. But it's in capitalism more generally. Lenin described it as imperialism, and much of the process remains very much the same. The finance capital, the merger, maybe not purely under an institutional arrangement where banks control the other fractions of capital, as Lenin borrowed from Hilferding. But nevertheless, based on an export of capital, a rising crisis that has emerged really since the early 70s of what's called in the Marxian jargon over-accumulation of capital. In Lenin's time, that was organized through nation-states with colonial hinterlands. It's obviously much more complex today with a sort of superpower in Washington, but certainly the same process of crisis displacement to those areas geographically that are less able to resist. So we call globalization, in a sense, the emergence of that crisis and its displacement, other people, other places bearing the load. But it's not just a spatial problem. The other phenomenon that we want to focus on briefly is the temporal, how crisis gets displaced across time. And that's not just speed up of the work process, the space-time compression, but it's also finance, allowing the big bubbling of debt to, in turn, ensure that if you've got an over-accumulation problem now, maybe some consumer debt, some corporate debt can pay for that now, but of course, later on requiring more super-exploitation to repay the debt. So we've only got a temporary displacement of the crisis through this financial bubbling. Nevertheless, it's there where we see both power and vulnerability. So I have a slide that shows where I think that financial crisis has begun to manifest itself in reactions to the crisis, reactions that explicitly in five areas, certainly still led by the so-called Washington Consensus, where the U.S. Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve work very closely with the IMF, the World Bank, and those think tanks that associated with Washington, the British and German governments strongly allied, and indeed the South African government on my chart here going along with its own homegrown structural adjustment program. And you see some of the names, let's say, this process has a name and address, and we can find very, very strong partisans on behalf of maintaining Washington. But it's here where I want to come to some of the aspects associated with issue areas and alliances, because this is very thorny. This is where I think the international movement really needs a stronger anti-capitalist, anti-racist, anti-patriarchal ideology to assure that we're not making mistakes, especially where there are similar phraseologies and discourses against globalization, against the IMF and World Bank emerging from the very far right. The resurgent right wing in the U.S. certainly to restore the traditions of xenophobia and isolationism, to indeed evoke anti-Semitism in blaming this problem not on capitalism but on the banks. And Pat Buchanan and the populist crowd around him, as well as some officials in the U.S. Government and even establishment folks like Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, have also called, as we have, as we continue to do for the end of the IMF, where there are momentary tactical convergences between our forces in the global justice movements, and these we have to be exceptionally careful because those have come up and probably will continue to do so. More worrying in some ways is the ability of the system to reproduce itself by deepening the oppression under the rubric of reform. So here's one of the terrains in which, again, global justice movement folks are sometimes led dangerously into the thought of reform of these institutions. For about 20 years, for example, the World Bank has been subject to reform movements around gender and environment and transparency, participation, and even a post-Washington consensus moment with Joseph Stiglitz attempting to change that ideological, rigid free market approach. There are still, in the United Nations, very strong emphases, and that's why this Rio Plus 10 conference, where there's a huge amount of mobilization beginning around the world and in South Africa, by the way, that's next September, not this September, will be very important to test the very, very clear limits, the Kyoto-type protocol limits on global warming, for example, as well as aspects of water, which is one of the two themes of Rio Plus 10. Third world nationalists is a fourth current, where we've seen a resurgence around some of the rhetoric of anti-imperialism that used to flow so naturally from newly liberated governments. And I think where Mahathir Mohamad has combined that with an anti-Semitism fighting George Soros on currency speculation, or Robert Mugabe, for example, just north of where I work, and I've spent some time in Zimbabwe, combining an anti-imperialism with very, very venal repressive policies at home, make this very complicated. There may be some liberatory elements there, perhaps with Castro, Chavez, maybe even Aristide in Haiti, but we're looking very, very closely at where there are also extremely dangerous repressive tendencies in these alliances. But typically, the project of third world nationalism appears to be very much to join the system on fairer terms, perhaps in alliance with post-Washington consensus reformers. And finally, in our camp of justice movements, we see very explicit divisions, and some with tendencies even momentarily to ally in Washington, for example, recently to deny the World Bank the ability to impose cost recovery on health and education, required some of the leftists around Ralph Nader to work with conservatives in the U.S. Congress, quite a dangerous phenomenon. So that's, a situation based on where they are, but to the extent, and maybe Jaggi will bring this up more, that we have common discourses occasionally with right-wing forces against globalization, extreme care to win over forces and not to tamper with the anti-Semitic and anti-black, anti-gay, and anti-woman tendencies in those movements have to be taken. I'll, without going into the variety of different movements, some are certainly aiming to do a global project, a project of international reform in which the United Nations might carry some mode of international regulation of environment or Tobin tax-based strategies. Others are much more based on delinking and trying to move forward the localized and sometimes nation-state-based projects associated with sovereignty and disassociation from global capitalist circuits. Let me give you very quickly four examples. I'll do them in about 2 minutes each, but we can talk more in the workshops perhaps if you like. One would be areas where post-Washington consensus reformers are interested in making the international trade system less transparently exploitative. And they've talked to, for example, the AFL-CIO, maybe some Canadian labor, about so-called social clauses, trying to put in to the WTO, to trade deals, side agreements on environment and the labor and health and safety standards. Those are quite dangerous, and much of the radical movement argumentation in the South is to do a rejection of the WTO as a site of reform. Walden Bellow, for example, calls this explicitly the wrong agenda, and instead to promote the idea of solidarity so that sanctions against a country that entail exposure of its child labor, of its failure to have trade union rights, or the problems of safety and health in the workplace would be evoked in the way that you always listen carefully to, say, black South Africans calling for sanctions against apartheid, or the Haitians who, when Aristide was in exile, called for your solidarity and sanctions, or the Burmese Democrats today who call for sanctions against the junta. So until and unless the movements affected are actually calling for the social clauses, it's certainly wise to avoid reform of the WTO with such, I would posit to you. I think, secondly, the kind of solidarity that I mentioned that really does work entails, to some extent, in this case, I want to mention AIDS and antiretroviral drugs. The big pharma corps who had through discriminatory pricing, very, very much milked the pockets of wealth in the world, and South Africa has pockets of wealth where people can afford antiretroviral drugs at very high prices, but left the vast masses, in our case in South Africa, about 5 million people without access to life-saving drugs. Initially, Mbeki's regime made some overtures towards stealing the patents and doing what's called compulsory licensing so we could get generics produced. Then, after pressure from the U.S. government, backed off that. And then once ACT UP and the Medicine Sans Frontières and the big front of international forces pushed the issue, and earlier this year pulled the pharmaceutical companies out through mass protest and pressure from their lawsuit against Mbeki. Mbeki again grabs defeat from the jaws of victory by questioning whether these drugs will work and refusing still today to give a shot of nevirapine to a pregnant HIV-positive mother to save the child's life. So it's an extraordinary process that continues and again raises questions. It's a great example of the solidarity from south to north, where I'm sure in Canada you've been made aware of this, Canadian companies as well involved in this. And I'd like to mention as a third example a site where this will also increase in coming weeks and months, and that is water. Because I had a chance to attend this Vancouver Water for People and Nature conference and saw a very good anti-capitalist spirit emerging from the Council of Canadians and all of the allied groups there. If you check the website of Z Magazine, my report on that will be up in the next few days, www.zmag.org. And an anti-capitalist sort of sentiment to decommodify water, to de-stratify access, so it's a universal entitlement, a rights discourse, to degender the access and to assure more harmonious society-nature relations. Those four areas would be common themes for all this solidarity. And I think where, for example, the Acres International, a big Canadian company, do just the opposite by building dams in Lesotho that make it impossible for poor people in South Africa to afford water, especially in the Johannesburg townships, you'll be seeing calls for solidarity against companies of that sort and our attempts to bar them from any future work because they bribed officials in Lesotho to build a dam that is unnecessary. Finally, the point to make about finance, because that is, as I say, where a lot of the power and the vulnerability emerge together and where a lot of very, very exciting South solidarity calls are being made. Calls for the World Bank to be shut down through the World Bank bonds boycott, a call made by South African Jubilee, Brazilian Movement of the Landless, a number of other groups, www.worldbankboycott.org, and I'll give you more information about the need to really defund, to shut that institution at the nerve center of Washington's the boot on the neck of the third world. But there are plenty of others, and unfortunately, Jubilee movement in the north, with the exception of Canada, was unable to really pull this through. To listen to Jubilee South, Jubilee Canada is probably the best example, along with allied left-wing religious forces, and I have some of their propagandists, excellent stuff, to really listen to the call from the South. And that call is not for HIPIC. It's not for a highly indebted poor countries initiative. The poorest of the poor get a little bit of crumbs of debt relief with, again, the same old structural adjustment conditions attached. It's increasingly to have their national leaders default, to form a cartel to default, to repudiate and to demand reparations for the ecological debt and for debt paid, illegitimate debt, odious debt that your Canadian banks and others made to dictators. Jubilee South is a movement out of Nicaragua, South Africa, and the Philippines, and its website http://www, then it's aidc.org.za. Let me wrap up by saying that those are the kinds of calls that it seems to me those interested in listening to the appeals of the organized radical movements of the South should be very sensitive to. I know you are. I know your own traditions in Canada, including the work in Southern Africa and Latin America, has sensitized you in a surgical way to that kind of solidarity driven by the South. It's incredibly inspiring for our comrades in South Africa to feel it in Toronto, in other places. They've got folks listening to them. And their invitation, certainly to you, is to come to Johannesburg, September 2002, to end neoliberalism once and for all. It allows me to pass to Jaggi, who's going to then talk to you about the nature of these big protests, the big mass actions. We need more of them. We need to bring them with all of the synergies that you have from Toronto to places like Johannesburg. Join us there, comrades. Thanks.